You're listening to Well Made, a podcast presented by Lumi about the intersection of business and design. I'm your host, Stefan Ango, and today we're talking to my good friend, Eva Goikochea. Eva is a brand strategist. She's a master of using minimalism to present companies and products in the clearest, simplest way possible. She helped define the look of the e-commerce fashion site Everlane, and since then, she's been working with a long list of small businesses to help build their brands online. She's also an entrepreneur in her own right. She's the founder of a watch company called Tinker and a condom brand called Maud. Hi, Eva. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How long have you been in New York now?
Okay. It will be 3 months on the 2nd.
You left us all here in Los Angeles. I don't know what to do anymore. What's going on in New York?
It's funny because I moved here and our apartment feels very much like our old house. And my day-to-day routine is almost the exact same. So I don't know if there's much of a difference Monday through Friday. But I think we just wanted to be more in a city proper. And we lived in downtown LA for a few years and it was great, but it wasn't enough. And then we moved to a house and we felt pretty isolated because we both work from home. So, and Ian always wanted to live in New York and I went to school here. So I knew what I was getting myself into and I'm waiting until the middle of winter to see what Ian thinks about living here.
Well, whenever I go home to visit my parents who live in Paris, it's I remember why, you know, fashion can exist in cold places. It's like all these cool layers and you know, you get to actually wear interesting things when we're, you know, sweating our asses off here in Los Angeles. It's very hard to wear something cool. Everybody's just wearing flip-flops.
Oh, man, we could have a whole podcast on flip-flops.
I have very strong opinions about flip-flops. Don't get me started. We should tell a little bit about, well, how do you describe yourself when you when you tell people about what you do? What do you tell them?
So I'll usually say I'm a brand strategist and web designer, but I feel like an imposter when I say I'm a web designer because I do work every day on Squarespace and often on Shopify and sometimes on WordPress, but I'm not a developer. So that's how I describe myself. And then I'll throw in, and I co-founded a watch company to which they sort of give me a quizzical look.
I want to get into that in a second, but tell me a little bit about like the kinds of clients that you work with when you're building these websites.
I think I have a unique situation from what I understand in speaking to other Squarespace specialists. I get a lot of inquiries every week. And I don't ever actively search out clients. Yeah, I mean, I've basically, since the time I became a Squarespace specialist, have never had to go see clients. And while that sounds great, it's not so great most of the time because I'm accepting work that I wouldn't necessarily show. But because I'm so busy, in order for me to, like, you know, sit down and think about what kind of clients I want to work with, I would have to have more of a plan for what my so-called studio is. And I don't have a plan for it. I've just been doing this while, you know, I've been in this 18-month purgatory of waiting for our watches. So anyway, the kind of clients I work with, it ranges. It's anywhere from like small businesses in every industry to e-commerce clients to people who want to personally brand themselves online.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems, I would guess, that a lot of people find out about you through Instagram or some of the other things that you've done, like your work with Everlane. I'm guessing if people come to you, it's for the aesthetic that you bring to it, right?
Actually, so no. Instagram and this so-called reputation that I have elsewhere has nothing to do with the clients that I end up getting. What happens is that they search for Squarespace designers, they end up on this Squarespace specialist page. And then I would say that I stand out because my style is so minimal compared to most of the designers on the page. And that's how I get the client. But they do not, I would say 95% of the time, if not more, they do not look at what I've done, where I've come from, anything. And that creates a really interesting relationship. One that has gone well most of the time, because over the course of our project, they'll get to know me and then they'll look more into it. But sometimes I wish that they would have read so that they would trust me or that the tone was better. It's basically like they treat you like a monkey for hire.
Well, that's fascinating. It totally breaks my conception of how your studio works. So what do you get out of that reputation? You must, maybe some of the bigger projects that you work on are related to what you do on Instagram and other places? Or is that just an outlet for yourself and they're completely separate worlds?
They're actually really completely separate. The issue is that, and I deal with this a lot when I teach this branding class, and I talk to people a lot about how they brand themselves in order to work with clients. And a lot of them are on the same boat that I am, which is that they've done things that don't seem to relate. And so to put that online, you have to figure out what your angle is. So on my site, I have like Instagram partnerships. You know, I've been sent to Hawaii, for instance, to shoot, and they don't care what I do 9 to 5. When I get somebody who inquires about working with me on brand strategy and digital content, they've done their research and they know where I'm coming from. And those are, you know, they're great clients. The only thing is that those are typically like long-term projects, and I don't take them on or haven't taken many on since we started Tinker. So yeah, when people are like, oh, you run your own design studio, I'm like, well, I don't feel like I have a studio per se. I feel like I just built websites for people and then send them on their merry way.
So tell me a little bit about the minimal aesthetic that you were talking about. How did that come about? Where did that come from?
I think I've always been drawn to really clear messaging. I studied advertising and marketing and then moved back to California and finished my degree in organizational communications. So communication and messaging have always been something that I've talked about and read about and thought about. And I mean, when I started building websites, I realized that in some cases I was paring down people's vision of what their website should be. And over time that just became how I thought of things. So even when I'm starting from scratch, I'm thinking about messaging and then the images and how cohesive their images are, while it's really important, almost comes second. But I think a lot of times people create websites that are really, they're confusing and they're not memorable. So I try to create something that's really memorable based on very concise messaging and clear images.
That's fascinating, and it's a very different different answer. I am very much in the minimalist camp, but I think I come at it from a very different angle. I went to industrial design school, and the people that I looked up to were folks like Dieter Rams and the Eames and all those types of people who were kind of building the modernist aesthetic during the 20th century. And I've just been trying to replicate all their good ideas my whole life, you know, and looking to kind of Japanese culture and some other things like that. I think it's really interesting that you're coming at it really from a more logical place in a way, and that's where they started too. You know, how do you explain something clearly and simply?
Well, I often walk through the world thinking, oh, I would love to rebrand this business and help them with their website, even if it's not something that I'm interested in, which is actually why I like my day-to-day. I like working with clients whose brands or products I wouldn't necessarily use. To me, it's almost like democratizing minimalism, like taking this vision that I have for how a website should look or what your messaging should be or what makes a beautiful image and helping them see it through their own lens. So rather than trying to work with clients who I totally align with and whose products I may use or restaurants I may go to, etc., I just try to work with a client where I see potential for clarity.
It's interesting because I do think that minimalism is not always the right answer, at least in some projects. I think there's so much potential for really explosive, interesting typography and colors and that kind of stuff. Especially I see it in museums and events and restaurants also sometimes. Places that you're not expected to look at all day long, you know. I do really believe in minimalism when it comes to products and tools and utilities and things that you're interacting with a lot. But for things that are these like small experiences or temporary experiences, it feels nice to have something that has a lot of personality, a lot of intricate quality or colorful or explosions or of like chunky typography and that kind of stuff. And I'm curious, what do you think about that? Or is that a style that you don't really work in yourself?
I would say that based on the types of clients that are coming to me, you know, clients who are not usually exposed to design, they want help. If you think about it, they're like, okay, I've seen this Squarespace ad, or I listened to a podcast with a Squarespace ad. I'm a regular person somewhere in the country and I don't know what I'm doing. I've got on Squarespace and I don't understand. They're really coming from a place of not knowing what to do. So they don't take a lot of risks. It's a challenge sometimes to get them to take more risks. I use tools on a regular basis that help me help them take more risks. But I don't get to work with avant-garde clients or clients who are really design forward, because those are the clients that go and seek out people who have positioned themselves as running an agency or a studio, or they're going within network. I mean, we're talking about like an audience that already knows design, and I don't work with those people. And to go back to that word democratizing, I mean, that's what Squarespace does, although they realized in creating this DIY product that it's actually not DIY for a lot of people. So it's a segment of the population that wouldn't probably let me use chunky type.
Well, it is interesting because to some extent, they are picking you over other people and seeing, you know, they are making some sort of aesthetic decision when they ask you to help them.
I would say that, yes, they're making a choice, and a lot of them are very complimentary and say, I really liked the work that I saw of yours on the specialist page. But I also would say that I just look different than what's there. And I've thought, like, I'm in a very funny time. So I have this watch company and the watches are about to arrive and everything could change in the next 6 months. But let's say it doesn't change and we're all still doing our day-to-day work. I've thought about, do I grow this studio? Do I start working with a developer and a graphic designer? Because I'm getting so much work and there's a potential to build it out and have more of a point of view. So that's where I am right now. So I would love to work with clients who are much more design forward, but I think I'm just not ready to go seek out clients quite yet.
I love the fact that you get exposed to so many businesses that are coming at this from a different perspective, who might not know what they're doing. And I do agree that Squarespace and some of these other tools, and in fact, what we're trying to do with Lumi is like, trying to help them not make bad decisions, so to speak, like try to help them avoid the pitfalls of bad design by in a way not letting them do that. Because I think Squarespace does a very good job giving you really nice looking default stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I have to basically, there's like a crash course in the beginning of getting them to think about all of the components of a website as it relates to their business. And sometimes these are people who've had businesses for so long that you're really trying to like re-engineer what they think about their own business. And it's tricky, but I'm glad that they've already considered Squarespace, so I'm not having to convince them of the tool. I just need to get them to give me the information that I need so that I can use the tool.
But when you talk about, we're talking about websites, but you're also talking about photography, typography, like the whole kind of brand aesthetic that they're trying to build, right?
Yeah, and I think, okay, for instance, I work with Compass, which is a very large real estate company. They're very big in New York. They're in other cities right now, and they're sort of, their UX is like the Airbnb of real estate. They have like 700 brokers that they work with. So they need all of these one-off sites. They're the type of client that comes with me with a brand book, brand guidelines, the files, everything. And they don't want to learn Squarespace. They just say, these are the things you need, like go run with it. Then I work with these small clients who don't have any of that, but I'm not a graphic designer. I'm not going to create a whole brand identity for them, but I recognize that I'm maybe setting the tone and going backwards. Like their website will then set the tone for what they perhaps explore with a graphic designer or what they do with their collateral. So it's kind of a funny place because they'll come to me and they'll be like, okay, I want you to do everything. And I'm like, I'm not going to do all of this. We're going to get your website to create a vision for what you think your brand is. And then you can use that as a jumping off point. So that's how I work with people. It's in one of two ways. It's like everything's handed to you or you're trying to like give them something without building the whole thing. Because that's a long process. And I think it really takes somebody who builds logos and ID.
Yeah, so let's talk about Tinker for a second, because I think it plays into this. What was the inception of that idea? Like, where did that come from?
From my side of things, when I left Everlane, which I was at Everlane for a year and a half, and I was there from the very early stages. So I was lucky enough to see really great growth. When I left, I knew that I wanted to work in physical product. And in the beginning of 2015, I met this guy, Grant, who has a design studio with a partner. We had this breakfast. It was actually funny because we ordered breakfast and it never came, and we didn't realize that it didn't because we were talking for so long. But him and his partner, Selena, talked about wanting to build something. They were going to do coats. They had this idea around creating a coat. This started this conversation of let's build something together. And we thought, what is universal, unisex, something that everyone can wear? And is it, you know, not just about one age or gender? And we came up with a watch. And we had this conversation for about a month, going through what it was going to be called and what it was going to look like and all these things. And then we realized we had no idea how to build a watch. And we called in my husband, Ian, who is a mechanical engineer, and he joined as our fourth co-founder, and he built the watch. So it was this idea of just like, let's just try to build a watch and let's see what happens. And how are we going to do this? And how can we put in just a little bit of money and go far? And that's what we did. I don't think any of us really recognize the fact that it's a company. It's real. It's very much this like thing we designed that will take on a life of its own once it's in someone's hands.
I thought it was really interesting that you guys decided not to do a Kickstarter campaign, or like how you decided to actually launch it is kind of fascinating to me. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Sure. So one of the first exercises we did when we decided to build a watch was going through the about pages of lots of other watch companies in the space. So we're talking about a quartz watch in the range of like $100 to $500. And every single one of those companies, and I won't name names, but every single one of those companies created these about pages that took themselves very seriously. Like, we're changing time and we're pushing the envelope. And we kind of laughed about it and thought, no, it's just a watch. And there's nothing that we could say on a Kickstarter other than we just want to build a great watch. We don't think we're changing the world. We recognize that it's just a watch. And a lot of the spirit of the company has been inspired by the Think Small campaign with a Volkswagen bug. So we couldn't justify creating a Kickstarter. Unless we were innovating greatly, or we were going to create this website that was so fascinating that you just couldn't not share it or something, we just could not justify and figure out the angle for a Kickstarter. But beyond that, we recognized that if we could each put in $1,500, which is what we did, we could build this watch. All we needed was 200 pre-orders. And I would say now that we look back on it and we're like, well, it would have set a better expectation for delivery time, because of course we're getting these emails now that's like, where's my watch? But we don't regret it. We built this company from the ground up and we didn't want help. And we didn't want to say like, we need help, because what do we need help for? We're just building a watch. We're not creating a new thing.
So how do you go about actually getting those pre-orders?
We're like, okay, the first order that we have to put in with this factory is 1,500 watches. And if we go hard and try to get a lot of press and email every single person we've ever met, then there's a potential that we could sell through the watches. So we set this minimum. We did the financial calculation, set the minimum to 200, and thought, okay, you have a lot of followers on Instagram, Eva, you go post about it. Oso has a lot of email subscribers, go email. Hit up every single one of your family and friends who would actually pay attention to this email. And then let's throw a party. And that got us to 200 watches.
Didn't you say it was 1,500 for the run?
Yeah, it's 1,500 for the run, but the amount of watches that we sold covered the run.
Okay.
We just didn't want to sell through the first run. We wanted to have watches in stock.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So that's what we did. We just reached out to our network.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. That I think that is the first thing anyone would do, whether it's on Kickstarter or any other method, is, you know, you probably know some friends or some friends of friends who can help you.
Yeah, and the other thing about Kickstarter is that, and we have friends who have done Kickstarters that have been successful and some haven't, mm-hmm. and there is a cost to produce like a video and the story. So we could take this money and like make the company, or we could take the money and produce a video. And we thought, let's just take the money and make a company.
Yeah, that makes sense. I love how you described your comparison to other watch companies and how they describe their watches. It reminds me of a book called Blue Ocean Strategy, which is the only good business book I've ever read. There's a lot of them out there, and a lot of them are just crap. But in that book, they describe the strategy of this Australian wine company, Yellowtail Wines, which is, I would say, known for selling cheap wine, but they approached it in a very similar way. They were looking at the wine market in the U.S. something like 20 years ago, and it was mostly just European and some South American wines that took themselves very seriously. Even American wines kind of took after that aesthetic, and you had to have the terroir and the chateau, and like you were trying to really create this aesthetic of this old world, very rich, snobby culture. And they looked at the wine market, which was very small in the United States at the time, and their goal was to appeal to beer drinkers. And so, because they felt that, you know, beer drinkers are 70% of the market, wine drinkers are like 5 or 10%. So why don't we make a wine for beer drinkers rather than make a wine for wine drinkers? And so if you look at the branding, it's very minimalistic, very simple. The words that they use to describe their wines are very simple and not arrogant in any way. It's like, you know, this is a juicy, whatever, red wine that tastes like grapes. Or I don't know how they describe it, but it's very simple, very colorful, and it worked. It became like the biggest wine brand in the U.S. very quickly. And I think there's always opportunities like that in almost every market to look at what's the established way of doing things and how can you do something differently. And I think it's very true for watches.
The whole point of the name Tinker is that we're giving you a choice when you build your own watch. The site is build your own watch. And that also comes from the same place, which is we're not going to make this decision for you. We want you to build a watch that you like. There's something in that we'll continue to build on. So I feel like that's where the evolution will come in for us. I feel like we're kind of like the little engine that could, and you never know, like this could grow into something much bigger, but we really don't have like a long-term plan right now.
Well, one of the things that interests me is that right around this time, we've also seen new things happening with the Apple Watch and Android watches and all that kind of stuff. Was that just coincidence, or does that affect anything for you?
No, I mean, if you look at the site, we spoke to that. We said always in airplane mode. We make the joke that it's no help in the dark, and it's sort of waterproof. I mean, if you want an Apple Watch, you're not in the market for a watch. You're in the market for a smaller version of your phone. So we didn't even think of them as something to worry about. And also, you could say that this idea that you have to pull out your phone to tell time, and it's a distraction when you do it, you're probably not just going to look at the time and put it away. I think the same thing can be said for your Apple Watch.
Yeah.
Maybe you just check it while you're in a conversation, and then that's it. But I feel like it's doing all of these other things, and those become distractions.
Yeah, it's interesting. I used to wear a watch constantly when I was a kid, actually. You know, from ages like 5 to 15, I probably wore a watch every day, and then I stopped. And when the Apple Watch came out, I was not a fan of it, which is weird because I'm usually a pretty big fan of all of Apple's stuff. But it did inspire me to buy a watch, an analog watch, which actually is made by a company called Instrument. It's very simple aesthetic as well. But it was inspired to some extent by the fact that I was seeing all these new contraptions people were strapping to their wrists and kind of feeling like I wanted to reject that.
Yeah, and I feel like in our preliminary conversations, we talked about how does a watch make you feel? And we almost thought that we would use that as the thing that we explored. Like we talked about building out the blog more and asking people how a watch made them feel, because everyone seems to have a reaction to wearing a watch. They feel like they're ready to work, or they're ready to go out, or it makes you recognize that you're like prepared. So we thought about exploring that, but that got into the territory of taking itself too seriously. And so I don't know. I don't know if that's where we'll go and we'll have those conversations, but we were fascinated by that idea.
Has it been satisfying for you creatively to be able to set the brand direction and kind of define this more for yourself since you've been working mostly with clients otherwise?
So I get a say, but I'm not the creative director. Selena is our graphic designer and creative director. Ian is the product developer and designer. And then Grant does all of our copywriting and strategy. So I do marketing and we'll do more social media. I'm the fourth person in this relay, basically. If I was going to create a watch company, it wouldn't look exactly like Tinker. Let me say this. I believe that we're like the shepherds of Tinker. We are not Tinker. And I felt the same way about Everlane. Even though Everlane's aesthetic was very close to my own, I was not Everlane. I worked at Everlane and I shepherded the brand and I was supposed to keep the sheep. So I feel like that's what it is with Tinker. It's satisfying, yes, but it's also, you know, a challenge to think like Tinker.
Well, it's going to be true no matter what, whenever you're working with other people on something, because you're automatically going to start, you know, cross-pollinating and bringing in some other opinions and other ideas, and it's going to have that shared aesthetic to some extent.
Yeah, and one of the brand exercises that I go through when I teach this branding class that I created, I mean, we did this for Tinker too. This is very basic stuff, but it's like, who is Tinker? Where do they go? What do they wear? Blah, blah, blah. And maybe that's not you, but I think it's great because it has a lot of personality, and that personality will grow and has so much potential. So I'm really excited about it. It's a brand that I want to work with. Even if I wasn't a co-founder, I'd want to work with Tinker, and probably more so than these really minimal brands like Instrument. Instrument makes a beautiful product. I don't think that Instrument's personality is really apparent.
Well, it doesn't have a personality. Its personality is, it's like the 1984 computer, Apple computer ad. It's like, it's the extreme of modernism. It's like, be as neutral as possible, you know?
And that would have been the easy way for us to go.
Yeah.
We all could have done that pretty easily, but we thought, how are we going? Like, what's the point of that?
Ouch. That's my watch. Hey.
No, I love their watches. I think they're beautiful. I own a Uniform Wears watch, which I love. I don't wear it currently because I am trying to be, you know, faithful to our brand, but I do love Uniform Wears, and I love Instrument. And Arc is also great. And there are a few brands that I really love. There are a few brands that I really think are shit.
Well, here's another question, and I don't know if you want or can get into this, but you have another project, Mod, which is also, I mean, it's still in early stages, but tell me a little bit about that if you can.
So Mod also came from...
Mod, M-A-U-D-E.
Yeah, M-A-U-D-E, also came from a conversation with Grant, Selena, and Ian. Grant and Selena had this idea, you know, to curate boxes with sex products, and that's been done. It's just not done very well. It started off as Hush. And the idea was that you could get these boxes and it wasn't apparent that it was sex products. First of all, we were like, okay, well, this means that we're basically managing all of these accounts with vendors to get all of these products. It turns into a much bigger thing than we wanted to get into. And it sort of evolved into, why don't we make our own product? How hard is it to make a condom? You know, what are the minimums? Like, let's go through the same exact thing that we went through with Tinker. At some point, Grant and Selena decided that they wanted to do something else. And Ian and I ran with Mod and now have two other partners. But Mod is a modern sex product company. The idea is that we will be making condoms, lubricant, and vibrators. And to use the word democratize again, like democratize sex. There are lots of condom companies and they all, to us, feel outdated or like they're aimed at one gender. And there's a lot of white space there. And I don't think anyone's doing it well. So that's the plan.
Yeah, I mean, so far it's still somewhat under wraps, but you can go to the website and see right away that it's going to be very different. I mean, the way you're approaching it feels a lot more appealing to me. It feels more honest to what sex is, you know? It's strange that I don't really understand what companies like Trojan or whoever, you know, the big companies that you think of, what their opinion is of sex. I don't know what it is. It doesn't seem clear to me, but it's definitely not what I'm all about.
Well, they've monopolized the market. They monopolized the market, I don't know, it was like in the 40s or 30s. I could be making that up. But it was like around then, they lobbied the FDA to make it a medical device, and then they took out ads in medical journals and they monopolized the market. Mod is actually a throwback to a time before Trojan where condoms were named, they had feminine names, a lot of them did. There was a brand called Three Merry Widows, and the widows had names. One of them was Agnes and the other two I can't remember. And the packaging was beautiful. And then Trojan came along and they changed everything. And I think they do think that they have a brand. And they very much do have a brand. It's just not necessarily a brand that has evolved. But they own the market. And so does Durex and Lifestyles. And they don't have e-commerce sites.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense. Yeah.
It does make sense. I mean, they work with distributors and that's their business. You know, there are condom companies like Sustain, which is a great company. It's very much aimed at women. You know, Sir Richard's out of Colorado, which I think could have been something and still is something. I just don't know why they haven't grown more. So there's like, there are some niche brands and then there's just the giants.
And so where do you want to take this? Is this an analog to Tinker in the sense that you want to put out, a sort of a curated set of products and keep it simple and then, you know, on a personal level, go and explore another area that can be simplified and modernized? Give me a gauge for like, you know, how much you put of yourself into each of these projects.
we want mod to be everywhere. We want mod to be accessible in places that you wouldn't normally find condoms. And we've talked about being on campuses and vending machines and being in hotel rooms and being in stores and not necessarily being in, you know, drugstores, maybe Target. I think having partners that align with the sensibility would be great. We want this to be a big company because we believe that, I mean, everyone has sex. You shouldn't be embarrassed to carry these things. The idea around the lubricant packaging and even the condom packaging is that you can have it in your house and not be embarrassed. And I just have no idea why it's still embarrassing. We also want to open up the conversation. We look to companies like Thinks. They've done a really great job of talking about something that half of the world deals with. So we want to talk about something that all of the world deals with.
I mean, I think it's just, it's a huge idea. And this conversation as a whole just reminds me of how much there is out there that is yet to be done. You know, I think that we're going through a crazy evolution right now in how retail works, what kind of brands can exist in the world, you know, that is very much being democratized. And there is just so much opportunity out there to make something that feels right for the time that we live in right now. And it frustrates me sometimes that people are not seeing those opportunities. It seems crazy.
I don't think that they're not seeing it. And this is where I think of Ian, and I'm not just saying this because I'm married to him, but I think of Ian as like a great resource in terms of production and understanding how to work with factories. It's not that people don't want to do things. I think they do. I think they don't know how to finance it. And we've worked through, like, how are we going to grow this? How much of our own money do we put in? We don't want to take on VC money. I think it's the challenge of how do you finance it? And then actually, how do you make it? I feel like a lot of people want to make things or they have great ideas. They just don't know how to make them, which is actually what I love about your company.
We're trying to help. You know, we went through that. But the thing is, for me, the thing that keeps me going pretty much is curiosity. It's just, I'm infinitely curious about everything. I want to know how everything is made. I want to know how the world works. And starting a company, there's no other school like it. It forces you to go down some rabbit holes that you had never imagined having to go through before. I'm sure that if you're, you know, investigating how to make condoms, it's like, you're learning so much about how all of that stuff works, the kind of manufacturing techniques, the incumbent companies in all those different areas. And I find that a fascinating school, personally.
Well, there is very much this like realization in most industries that there are only a few producers or there are only a few ways to produce things. And you look at Harry's, and I think they're like where we would eventually want to be in terms of owning the manufacturing process. Mm-hmm.
Harry's the shaving, yeah.
Harry's the shaving company. So latex is what people know. People know about polyurethane, but not as much as latex. And then like polyisoprene is being worked on and innovated. And I think, I mean, there's not like that many factories that make latex. It's just like, it's really interesting. So in that way, it's almost easier to make a product than you think. You just have to go to the source, and that's where the homework is.
Yeah, and that is one of our core tenets as well, is working directly with the source. And it's so crazy when you first start how many layers usually get built up on top of that initial factory or that initial, you know, material source. Most industries have layers and layers of middlemen and different people who get involved on top of that until it becomes the final product that you buy. And that can be a challenge. Maybe it takes a certain type of person, but that's the kind of like investigative work that I love to do.
Well, and I also think it sounds like I have no vision for Tinker. We're like, we don't know where we're going to be. We do have a vision for Tinker. Our hopes are not like low, but I think the idea is like one step at a time, and that curiosity and persistence has to come in the form of like every day working at it. Because in my mind, the more that I think about like the end goal, okay, one day we'll own a factory, I think it's then easier to say, I can't do it. So it's very much like, okay, have a plan and know that one day we want to be this, but right now we're just working on creating something.
Yeah. I mean, the vision can be as simple as, I just want to make a watch that I would want to wear. You know, it can be that simple and be the starting point that you need.
That is where the design came from. I really like Instrument, and I wanted something even more pared down. All of us have worn prototypes since they came out, which was in August of last year. And every day I look at my watch and I'm like, I love this watch. If this watch never comes out, if it never sees the light of day with a movement in it, which our prototypes don't have movements, like, that's okay. I'll just keep wearing this prototype because I love it. So yes, it is very much a watch I want to wear.
That's great. Well, is there anything that you want to share with anyone, where people should find you? If they want a great website, should they come to you? Or are you going to tell them, sorry, working on Tinker?
No, they can come to me. I would love to work with people who listen to your podcast. And you can find me at, and it's a long one, I know, I'm working on it, evagoicochea.com, which is evagoicochea.com.
We'll put a link in the show notes. And everyone should follow your Instagram, because it's like I feel like I'm at peace whenever I see one of your photos come in.
Oh, thanks. That's really nice. I really appreciate it.
What's your feeling about Instagram today?
I think it's changing. I've thought about it more as a discovery tool lately. I think that they're doing a better job of making things discoverable. So if you go follow someone now, you'll see people to follow underneath in a different format than they had before. And I use it to just find things. I follow so many people and I don't see most of their stuff. And I don't think it's about the followers that you have. I think it's about the people that you can find.
Are you getting on the Snapchat bandwagon yet?
Oh yeah, I'm on Snapchat often. And I think it's great to just be able to have like a silly outlet to capture things. I like Snapchat. I think it's honest. And I really, as someone who just moved away from a really wonderful community and I'm, you know, whom I miss dearly, I love looking at their snaps and seeing what they're doing in LA.
Does it have a place for branding? Do you ever use it from that perspective?
The only brand that I follow is Everlane, and I think they have done such a good job of producing content regularly that you look forward to and is just educational and interesting. So I think it can be used for brands if it's thoughtful.
Thoughtful is the word of the day.
I know. We should do a count on how many times I've said funny and thoughtful and innovative.
My word is cohesive. I feel like my job is head of cohesiveness. That's what I think is the only thing that I care about.
Well, it's funny because we didn't even get into, that's why I like my job. I'm like, oh, you have this site. It doesn't match. Let's just like make everything match. And also I have a site that I would be happy to share with people if interested called digitallycohesive.com.
Oh no. Wow. I don't even know about this website.
It's the website I use to teach my branding class. And there's a lot of good resources and creative resources and also business resources for running a small business. But there is a password. So
send Eva an email. Tell her you heard her on the podcast and she will help you out. Thank you very much, Eva.
Thank you so much. It was so good to catch up with you.